Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank the organizers, which includes myself this time, for allowing me to speak today about this work. It was done in collaboration with Achim Kempf, and it's related to Newton Cradle Spectra. So let's see what it is. One of the most basic questions in modern physics is what happens when we add two Hamiltonians? It's the old story of, we know the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of some Hamiltonian H0, maybe because it's a simple, well-known Hamiltonian, like the harmonic oscillator. And you know, by structural theorem, we can decompose it like so into its eigenbases, which you can visualize like the picture on the right, if it's a 3x3 Hamiltonian. And let's say we also know the eigenvectors and eigenvalues of some other Hamiltonian H prime. You can also visualize it on the bottom right here, but you don't have to. But the question then is, there's a hard problem that even if we know the eigenvectors and eigenvalues of each of those Hamiltonians individually, we still don't know so easily what the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the sum is. And typically, we approach this problem perturbatively. We do have some non-perturbative results, like the Wigner von Neumann result on level repulsion and Cauchy interlacing, but there are too few of those. And we all know this very well. And so here today, I will present a new non-perturbative result, which we called Newton Cradle Spectrum. So how does it work? This is the new thing. We start with a self-adjoint matrix S0, whose eigenvalues and eigenvectors we know. And so we can decompose it like this in its eigenbases. For example, if it acts on a three-dimensional Hilbert space, it has three eigenvalues, S1, S2, and S3. And we can visualize it as in this picture, we put it on a real line. Nothing special. Now the question is, what happens when we add a projector onto a one-dimensional subspace? We add this projector to the matrix S0. How do the new eigenvalues behave? This question is really important because if we knew the answer to it, then we also know the answer to the question of what happens when we add an entire matrix to S0, because any self-adjoint matrix can be decomposed into a sum of projectors. So adding projectors one by one constructs an entire self-adjoint matrix. So knowing the answer to this question will teach us also about the full question of what happens when we add two Hamiltonians. So this is what happens when we add a projector to a matrix S0. Generically, the overlap between the vector V and an eigenvector of the matrix S0, here I called it Si, generically this overlap is non-zero. And generically we get this behavior that we called the Newton cradle. The way it works, it's following. I call mu this number multiplying the projector in the upper left formula. I call it the coupling constant because you can think of it as a coupling constant if this projector was an interaction Hamiltonian. Okay, so as we start increasing mu from minus infinity to some finite number, you see that the smallest eigenvalue, S1, goes from minus infinity to some finite value. It increases from minus infinity to some finite value, while the other two eigenvalues just slowly increase. And then as mu gets bigger and bigger and becomes positive, then all of a sudden the largest eigenvalue, in this case S3, overtakes. And then as mu gets very large and it goes to plus infinity, S3 also takes off and it goes to plus infinity. So it's kind of like Newton cradle, because the smallest eigenvalue comes from minus infinity, then kind of kicks the other eigenvalues, and then the larger overtakes and then goes away to plus infinity. And here I can show you an example with four eigenvalues where exactly this kind of thing happens. Now, note that now mu is first going to increase from minus infinity to plus infinity, and then it's going to decrease from plus infinity to minus infinity, because this is how Mathematica creates movies from animations. You can see the Newton cradle-like behavior of eigenvalues. Note that all the time as mu increases, all the eigenvalues also increase, though not at the same rate. So some of them move faster at some times and the other slower, but that doesn't matter. They are always moving in the same direction as we increase mu. Okay, so let's talk about the properties of this Newton cradle. So first of all, what I just said, the eigenvalues always all move in the same direction, which we can prove with the formulas that we've derived. Another property that we have now for some eigenvector of S of mu, I can tell you exactly what this eigenvector S is expressed in the original eigenbasis of the eigenvectors of S0. So we have exact, you know, non-perturbative expressions. We can calculate exactly what the new eigenvector is expressed in the original eigenbasis. Another thing that we now know is that the spectra cover the entire real line exactly once. So that means that if you take all the eigenvalues and for all coupling for all values of coupling constant mu, we get that they cover the entire real line exactly once. And one consequence of this is that for any real number s, we know that there is a coupling mu for which s is an eigenvalue of s of mu. That's the formula in the middle. And moreover, we can calculate exactly the coupling constant mu for which s is an eigenvalue using this formula. Again, another non-perturbative result. And if you don't like formulas, you can just look at the plot. As mu increases from bottom to top, it goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, you can see how the spectrum changes. You know, just make a cross section for fixed mu. I wanted to mention the Cauchy's interlacing theorem, which is not too hard to understand. Paraphrased, what it says is that you start with an n by n a self-adjoint matrix M, which has eigenvalues S1 to Sn. For example, this matrix M here, which is a 4x4 matrix, it has its own eigenvalues. Then what you do is you cross out a row and a column, and you get a new matrix by doing that. Now the Cauchy interlacing theorem tells you that the new eigenvalues interlace the old ones. That's the formula in the bottom right, in the red rectangle. And we can, with this Newton cradle spectra procedure, we can explain and calculate the new eigenvalues in Cauchy interlacing. And how does that work? Well, if you note the formula that I mentioned a couple of slides ago, which connects the coupling constant to the eigenvalues, we can use that formula to calculate the Cauchy interlacing eigenvalues. We just look at what happens when the coupling constant goes to infinity. And then if you recall how S of mu is defined, if you look at this underlined part of S of mu, which is the projector, we see that when mu goes to infinity, that the subspace spanned by the vector v, it decouples because it's multiplied by something that's infinite. So it's like deleting a row and a column that correspond to the projector VV. And so now that we know this, we know what the formula for calculating the interlaced eigenvalues is. It's simple, we just plug in mu equals infinity and we get this formula in the bottom right corner. And we can see it exactly in the plot, that the interlaced eigenvalues are the asymptotes of the mu of s dependence. And you can see that they always interlace. No matter the details of the setup, you know, which vector V you choose and not, it's a robust feature, just like in the Cauchy interlacing theorem, that the new eigenvalues always interlace the old eigenvalues. Similarly to the Newton's cradle of self-adjoint operators, we can also talk about Newton's cradle of unitary operators. Similarly, as before, we start with some unitary matrix U0, which has its own eigenvalues and eigenvectors that we know. But now, unlike the case with self-adjoint operators, where we created the Newton's cradle by adding a projector, here instead we act with a family of U1 operators. And it's parametrized by this parameter alpha, which goes from 0 to 2 pi. The way the U1 operator acts on U0 is that most of the time it acts as identity, and only in the subspace spanned by this vector W, it adds this phase e to the I alpha. And again, we have a similar behavior as for the self-adjoint operators, except in this case, because it's a unitary operator, its eigenvalues now live on the unit circle in the complex plane. So the cradle is going to also appear on the circle instead of, you know, as real values on the real line. You'll see how one eigenvalues goes to the other, and then that one goes to its neighbor on the right, and you'll see how it works. So again, because of the Mathematica exports animations as moving in this way, you can see as alpha goes to 0 to 2 pi, they're all moving in the same direction. And then when it reverses the direction from 2 pi to 0, then again, they're moving in the same direction. So again, we have the same behavior. As the parameter alpha increases, all the eigenvalues are moving in the same direction. Now, maybe it looks a little bit strange that I'm talking about these two different Newton cradles, but the two are actually connected, and they are exactly related by Cayley transforms. The Cayley transforms are these formulas in the first, you know, in the second line. Now they look a little bit complicated, but they are not that complicated. When you look at the eigenvalues of the unitaries and the eigenvalues of the self-adjoints, they are related by a Möbius transform. So it's just, you know, transforming a real line into a circle or a circle to a real line. And the reason why we use the Cayley transform, well, we proved all those features, all those theorems that I mentioned in previous slides, we proved that using unitaries. And then we use that to map onto self-adjoints, which is, of course, often more interesting in physics. And I just want to mention that we have also a formula for an exact relationship between the coupling for the self-adjoints, mu, and the alpha parameter of the U1 family on the unitary side. And the formula looks like that in the lower left corner. And if you prefer a plot, the plot is in the lower right corner. As mu goes to infinity, alpha also takes the value, the special value of alpha star, where we get in the unitary side something like interlacing, but for unitary operators. And the take home message here is, well, you know, we learned in our physics education that addition of self-adjoint operators does not translate nicely to multiplication of unitaries. And it's because of the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. But here I want to say it does translate nicely to multiplication, but not of the exponentiated unitaries and instead of Cayley transformed unitaries. One more thing I wanted to mention is level repulsion. Level repulsion is a phenomenon where we start with some self-adjoint operator A, which has its eigenvalues. In this case, in this picture, it's E10 to E40. Those are the initial eigenvalues. And then people noticed many, many years ago, I don't know exactly when, but this is old news, that if we add a Hamiltonian to this original Hamiltonian A, if we add a Hamiltonian B, and we vary the coupling strength of the Hamiltonian B, we notice that sometimes the eigenvalues, the neighboring eigenvalues seem to approach each other. And when they should, you know, when you think maybe they will collide or cross each other, they, most of the time, almost always, they do not cross each other. So the question was, you know, why is this, why does there exist this level repulsion? Why do the levels don't want to cross? And by understanding Newton's gradle, we can start understanding the phenomenon of level repulsion. The way we do this is that we decompose the Hamiltonian B into a sum, you know, a sum of its projectors. Bi here are its B's eigenvectors, and Bi are its eigenvalues. And then we know that we can add projectors Vi one by one. We can always decompose every Hamiltonian into a sum of projectors. Now, what we learned from Newton's gradle is that as long as the overlap of Vi, the projector, with one of the eigenvectors of A is non-zero, there will be no level crossing. And typically, the overlap is non-zero. So typically, there is no level crossing. So Newton's gradle even allows us to understand this phenomenon. Okay, that's all for today. I want to summarize what I've talked about. First, I've talked about how eigenvalues and eigenvectors change as we add a one-dimensional projector to a Hamiltonian. In particular, we learned that eigenvalues move like the Newton's gradle. Secondly, we can decompose any Hamiltonian into a sum of one-dimensional projectors, which means that we now have a new strategy for understanding addition of Hamiltonians. And this is non-perturbatively. And all of this gave us a new insight into Cauchy interlacing and level repulsion. And there are many applications, I'm guessing, of the Newton's gradle, because, you know, spectra are everywhere in modern physics. But a few applications that I could mention today, first of all, adiabatic quantum computing. Adiabatic quantum computing is equivalent up to a polynomial overhead to algorithmic quantum computing. And the first results that we have about adiabatic quantum computing, now we have new insights into how algorithmic complexity translates into gap narrowing, which leads to slowdown of computation. And if you want to know more, I have some slides about it. So I prepared some slides, so please ask. Furthermore, we have that an application to Shannon sampling. If you don't know, Shannon sampling shows the equivalence of discrete and continuous representations of information. And this result here allows us to have a generalized sampling theory, which allows, you know, finite number of samples and varying information density. We didn't have that before. And other applications that are in progress, application to BBT transition in quantum chaos and Casimir-like forces, spectral geometry, and basically wherever there's a spectrum, I suppose something can be done. And that's it. Thank you for the attention, and paper will be on archive tomorrow.
Are there any questions?
Can I just ask from here? Oh, sorry.
No, you can.
Yeah, just speak up again.
Barbara, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So this whole thing, like if you look at it as if the mu was a time parameter, it really looks like these particles interacting, right? As if you had like a collision between particles that are undergoing trajectories and they bounce on each other and they interact somehow, and I mean, the whole picture looks like this, right? Could you estimate the potential that would be the interaction between these particles or something like this? Like, can you find a Newton, like, you know, Newtonian potential itself that really does the, exactly the same job as this?
No, I haven't done that. I guess maybe you could try doing that, but I haven't. I mean, that's like a meta-level analysis, right? So I'm already using Newton's cradle as an analogy, so that would be... But I haven't done it, but I think it would be interesting.
Yeah. It would be nice to, like, if you want to compute the spectrum, you go to the lab and you shoot some particles, and then you see the solution. But yeah, thanks.
I have a question, maybe a bit too technical, but the formula you showed for mu and those suggests that, like, first of all, I think you're working in the finite dimensional case for the space. Do you know if you can extend this to, like, infinite dimensional case where, like, I don't know, like, you might have to think of the convergence of things, but it'd be cool if you can, like, extend to, like, you know, not just finite dimensional, I guess, spaces, but
it can be extended to infinite dimensions. The thing is that all of this started by you know there was a generalized Shannon sampling theory for infinite number of samples, discrete samples with varying density. It was not known if it could be done actually in finite dimensions because there was a technical difficulty in infinite, in crossing from infinite number of dimensions to finite number of dimensions, funnily enough. It's usually the other way around. But now we have this theory in finite number of dimensions. And yeah, as you take the limit, of infinite number of samples, things should work out.
Okay, so yeah, this is maybe a random question, but when you mentioned about the band crossing when you change the parameter, this reminds me a bit of the discussion of the degeneracy in quantum, degeneracy and symmetry in quantum mechanics, where in general, if there is some kind of degeneracy in the band crosses, then usually there will be some kind of symmetry at the state. Can you relate this symmetry to the observation of the neutron's cradle?
So the way to understand level crossing with Newton's cradle is actually very simple. It's when when a projector V, when it has a zero overlap with one of the eigenvalues, then you will see a level crossing. So that it's a kind of it's easy to understand when the levels cross in Newton's cradle. So you said that in condensed matter, when you have bands touching and so on, that's all usually associated with some symmetry, right?
Yeah.
Let me think. I guess that would mean that you have some subspace that does not contribute to the interaction, right? And then that would mean that the projector that we have here just doesn't act on a part of the subspace. And then that could be equal to symmetry, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not sure about this, but I think
I'll wait.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, so if you want to understand level crossing in this simplest, case of Newton's cradle with just one projector, then it's simple. If the projector VV has zero overlap with one of the eigenvalues, then that level will be crossed.
I think I have a really related and maybe the same question, but just from a different angle. Is what you're saying different if you, like, did we assume that the original matrix A wasn't degenerate? If you start with the degeneracy and then you're perturbing away from that, does that fall in the same analysis or is that different?
Okay, so if you, all of what I've said, you know, I didn't mention it, but it's all non-degenerate spectra, right? I showed all pictures where we had non-degenerate spectra. Now, if we have, you know, like, let's say two eigenvalues were the same, you would have the same behavior, you know, you add one projector, I think you would have the same behavior, but always one eigenvalue, you know, would remain. Only one of the two would kick off, right? And the other would stay in the place. If you add two projectors, then two of them would move, and so on. The calculation that I haven't done yet, but it should be doable, is, you know, how do the eigenvectors change? That's more interesting, because it's not obvious to me. You know, we have this formula of how the eigenvectors change, but if you have a degenerate subspace, you know, what's the chosen eigenvector that moves? If only one dimension of the two dimension moves, which, you know, the dimension is chosen, I suppose it's going to be a function of the projector V, but I haven't done the calculation. It should be, you know, kind of straightforwardly doable.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Are there any further questions? If not, let's thank Barbara again.